Okay, now I'm continuing this story from yesterday, what Mike was telling about this calculations of the plasma instability, what goes on, and Kanban used that for thermalization. This is work I've done in collaboration with Dietrich Boerdecker, as you see, and this paper has been published last year. I didn't put here the coordinates for the paper, but I put it on the web. Now, okay, we know the stages of the heavy ion collision, some characteristics, roughly 1 TeV per nucleon. This is kind of average of Rick and LHC, say. And gamma factor is of around 1,000. So the two nuclei collide, and they really look like almost infinitely thin sheets when they hit. I mean, 1 to 1,000 is the ratio between the thickness and the size of that sheet. And the initial state, as we now understand, and you can calculate it from QCD, that the relevant initial modes are so-called these colored glass condensate modes. The dominant wave modes of this nuclei before the collision are of order this QS saturation scale, which is of order few GeV for the collision energies at Rick or LHC. LHC is of course a little bit higher. And the nucleus looks like really like a salami pizza or something with lots of sausages, and it's full of them. I mean, so that this collision is guaranteed when they hit each other. They cannot just go past each other. You have such an, it's maximally occupied. I mean, that's what saturation here means. That I mean, you cannot just squeeze in any more partons. I mean, they would fuse into one parton, so that it's really maximally occupied. Sorry? Well, you can calculate it from QCD using evolution equations BK or then BFKL or nonlinear versions of that one, Jim Wilk or BK. And when you evolve this nuclei using chasing Bjorken X, for example, you see that you pop out new partons, pop, when you evolve closer to this kinematic region where you are now. And at some stage, I mean, you cannot just squeeze in partons, you must fuse. I mean, they have to start fusing, because they are they are gluons, of course, these partons, and they start to go together. So it's maximally occupied. For QED,
I mean, there's no direct evidence of
initial radiation.
It's you can measure it fit to the cross section. Yes. That's right. I mean, you observe geometric scaling. The best evidence comes from Hera deep in elastic scattering data that this thing really happens. However, of course, one has to admit that even without the assumption of saturation, you can fit to the Hera deep in elastic data using DCLAP evolution equations. But where you don't see it so directly, but in principle it is also there. So that I mean, these are two different evolution equations in QCD.
You don't use geometric cross section as an argument because it applies at any energy.
Yeah. Cross section is any
energy. Nevertheless, this is a side point. I mean, doesn't matter if it is color class condensate or anything, as long as we have this kind of scale, and this comes naturally. I mean, even when you take some alternative viewpoints to this collision. So these hit each other. And sure enough, I mean, we don't know really what happens. I mean, I would say that this is kind of something you can derive from QCD, but I have difficulties in imagining what happens in the instant when these two really go through each other. They are strong fields, maximally occupied, so certainly strongly interacting. Some funny things can happen. But what seems natural is, of course, that you kick up wave numbers of QS. I mean, modes of QS momentum there. And they must dominate. And it's most likely very strong fields, again, probably maximally strong, fully occupied modes at the very initial states. And I guess this has now acquired this name, glasma, this state of the matter. At least some people call it like that. And at very rapidly, I mean, when these separate from each other, point one Fermi is actually already so long time that they have long since passed each other, these nuclei. I mean, because they are so thin, at least geometrically speaking, this might be too naive to talk about this kind of geometric construction. So that they have really, really gone through each other. And this has expanded a lot already, this stuff in between. and it's called melting of this condensate when this happens. You start to get some partons, typically with this QS momentum scale, and obviously it's very anisotropic. Why it should be isotropic? Distribution is probably very non-thermal. And now, experiments seem to indicate the fit to the hydrodynamics that at around one Fermi you already are isotropized or thermalized. So it's very rapid this isotropization, and the expansion goes on, and around 10 Fermi you exit the plasma phase and go to hadronic phase and so on, and you observe the outcome. Now, I call this QS mode, saturation scale modes, few TeV modes, hard modes. And initial stages, I mean, there's some kind of distribution. I drew it here like a symmetric distribution. It could be almost any shape. It's very tough to say what is the right shape there. But when the system expands, time goes on, this hard mode distribution becomes dilute. I mean, assuming that they are just flying there, not interacting, for the lack of better knowledge, we expand the system, of course this mode density becomes smaller. And it in principle becomes perturbative. The coupling is weak and the density becomes small. And also the density, the distribution becomes squeezed along this beam axis direction. So you get these ellipsoidal shapes for the distribution. If you assume really free streaming, it's kind of red shifting to one direction only. And this is now the starting point of the bottom-up thermalization process. But what I want to point out here, that these are dilute and they are have hard energy. They are at high momentum scale, much bigger than lambda QCD. They behave a little bit like classical particles, and they are on-shell particles. Now, how this rapid thermalization then could occur here? What turns this initial non-thermal distribution to thermal quickly? There's a bottom-up thermalization picture, which is kind of the benchmark here, which just calculates perturbatively hard collisions. And there's a lot of development there, and typically you get dependence on the strong coupling constant, something like that. And it could even lead to thermalization relatively early, which is, as Mike said, I mean, not so bad. I mean, you can, it must depend on the calculation, because in some calculations this goes all the way to 10 Fermi, so that I guess it the factors in front here are significant.
So the claim is a follower, the factor is 1.
Yes. Yeah. But okay, plasma instabilities can still occur here, which Mike told yesterday. I mean, these are well known in electrodynamics, of course, studied in laboratory, and the bane of laboratory plasmas, like the fusion plasmas. And they always arise when you have a non-trivial current carrier distribution. And it could happen in QCD too. These hard modes are gluons, mostly gluons, practically all of them are gluons. So that they carry charge, and their distribution was anisotropic, as we described there. And that can lead to the exponential growth of softer modes, momenta, which is much smaller than QS. And this is called this plasma instability. And if now these very large, if these become non-perturbatively large, they can have back reaction to these hard modes. And that can then lead up to thermalization. And there's a long history of here, of authors who have been studying this. And this is parametrically much faster than this bottom-up thermalization. So that at least in some hyper-super-ultra collider, which goes to tremendous energies, I mean, this should be the leading candidate for thermalization. And the instability is a viable so-called filamentary instability. This is a little bit incorrect picture, but somehow it's more intuitive to draw it this way. If we have a current flowing along one plane here, along these red lines, let's say, or initially homogeneous along this plane, and we have no magnetic field in the system. And now if there are some small fluctuations in the current, so that at this point I have a little bit more current going this way than opposite direction, so that there's net current going there, that of course induces a magnetic field around it. And this magnetic field acts as to focus more particles going through there. So it amplifies the magnetic field, and there's a runaway effect. This is the plasma instability. And same thing here to the opposite direction. So it leads to the exponential growth of soft magnetic fields. And for QED, it means that this P soft is much smaller than P electron. Of course, usually this is classical, so that this is even non-relativistic momentum, not the relativistic P here.
Can you hold the different inertia between the protons and the electrons?
The fact
that the protons are much more massive than the electrons.
Yeah, protons don't contribute in plasmas at all. I mean, they are just standing there still. So it's, they are not moving in effect.
The protons are standing still.
Yes. Well, I mean, or moving so slowly that you can neglect them for the development of this. Or, there's a charge distribution which oscillates, of course, due to the protons, but it's much slower movement than the electronic movement.
It creates strong electric fields, I would imagine.
Yes. Well, I mean, typically, the electrons neutralize the proton charge distributions. I mean, if you have a lump of protons somewhere, it collects lump of electrons so that it's neutralized. And the electrons rush very rapidly there.
And the instability you just described really isn't magnetic instability.
Yes. It's not electric. Yes.
Would it develop an electric instability?
Not in QED. In the linear regime, at least. No, yeah, it shouldn't.
In the charge conjugation symmetric case of QCD, you can have electric instabilities as well. But that's just saying the picture can be more complicated. It starts with just what you said.
Yeah. In QCD, actually, you do get large chromoelectric fields, of course, too. Okay. Yes, this can be sort analytically as a function of this anisotropy, where analytically might be in quotation mark, analytically meaning that you don't use the lattice simulations, I mean, you can solve your differential equation or something like that. And now the thermalization effects comes from the fact that when the magnetic field is large, A soft is of order k electron, field bends the electron strongly, so that you typically do get the waves. Maybe I should throw on the light here. Waves, of course, I mean, if these are some kind of current going up and down along here, so that the magnetic field rotates around these currents. Now, the magnetic field becomes so strong that the electrons are bent, let's say 90 degrees on the length scale of this wavelength, then you rapidly lose this full coherence and you effectively thermalize this current distribution. And of course this electric magnetic field also becomes very chaotic and thermalized at that point. Yes, and this kind of stuff really happens in plasma physics all the time.
When you say chaotic, you mean turbulent?
Probably. Okay, now in isotropized. So in QCD, the same stuff happens. Substitute electrons by hard gluons, they carry charge. And soft electromagnetic field, soft gluonic field, of course. And in QED, in small amplitude soft fields, we can solve the analytically the growth rate. Actually, it's exactly the same calculation as in QED, because the non-linearities don't matter. If the field amplitude is small, we can just neglect all the commutators. And that leads to exponential growth of these very small soft fields. This happens in QED, yes. I mean
absolutely. I mean, the isotropic vibration would also happen in QED.
I think so, yes. I mean, this is one of the problems in the fusion plasmas, for example. I mean, you have a large currents there flowing around in this and magnetic fields, and this typically mess up your system, of course. And it is, well, even these instabilities, I mean, mess up your system. I mean, not to say anything about this isotropization there, so that because of this very strong response of the field to small deviations.
Do quarks play no role here?
Sorry?
Do quarks play no role?
Play a role?
Quarks.
You can neglect them. I mean, on the heavy ion collision, typically all of the hard modes are gluons. On the saturation picture, these partons are practically all of them are gluons. Of course, electrons are there in the mix, but they are vastly outnumbered by the gluons.
You can also include the quarks in the glue loop, and the only thing it does is modify the Debye match.
Exactly. Yeah.
Including the quarks increases the growth rate.
Yes. I mean, if you add on top of the gluons.
And you can also analyze the collected modes of the quarks themselves, and they're perfectly stable. They don't.
But I mean, the easiest thing to handle quarks here is to just add, let's say, quark contribution to gluons. I mean, add Debye mass due to the gluons, the amount what quarks would give you.
Just change the parameters.
Change the parameters.
Okay, this is the idealistic picture of arbitrary large separation of scales.
Yes.
Very, very weak coupling.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, question here in non-abelian fields is that now you have an exponential growth of soft fields. What happens when you hit the non-linear limit, non-abelian limit, when the soft field magnitude, C times A, is of order wave number? I call it K star. Here this wave number. K star is this wave number where these waves tend to grow, I mean, the separation. I mean, it's a typically, I mean, quite well localized, this wave number. And there are several alternatives. I mean, if it continues growing up to the limit, as in QED, so that this A soft is of order this hard momentum, then this would lead to very rapid isotropization. But it might also happen that this just quenches the growth, because suddenly the fields become nonlinear, the evolution becomes nonlinear, it doesn't grow anymore, so that it would differ from QED case or something else. And actually, this third option is the one which seems to be realized. Something else happens. It doesn't continue growing like in QED. It doesn't stop necessarily. It can stop, I will show it. But it can continue growing, but in very differently from QED case. And there was a proposal by Arnold, Lenagan and Moore, that these fields could abelianize. If you pick up one color direction in QCD only, it's effectively abelian. And the rest are, if they are zero. And this then would behave as an abelian field. However, this seems to be very unstable against deviation from this one color, so that this doesn't really seem to happen. At this point, I might actually just occur to me from yesterday's talk by Mike. He had this nice picture. Remember, we have here, let's say, a nice plot where we have momentum anisotropy p along beam axis divided by P perpendicular to it, and for these hard modes at some very early time, here I have time. Here is time, let's say, 1 over QS. Maybe it's then symmetric so that this is 1. This, I don't know what it was before. But then it, because the system expands, it becomes smaller rapidly. Actually, extremely rapidly initially. It slows down as the time goes on because in local frame, the expansion rate slows. And then something, maybe this bottom-up picture or this anisotropy sticks this up and maybe thermalize it. But the soft fields behave exactly opposite way. If they are isotropic, very small at the beginning, you will generate these waves which are along the beam moving along the beam ends. Actually, they are not moving, they are optional, they are stationary. But they are not perpendicular direction, so that their anisotropy is completely opposite, points upwards. And they will go down then when you hopefully thermalize at some point. So this is the hard part, and this is the soft part of the fields. And here is some thermalization time, maybe one Fermi, after which you can start your hydrodynamics going on. This is kind of guess here, of course, that's what happens. So let me go on. Okay. We want to study this with numerical lattice simulations. Why we need lattice? Because we have non-perturbative fields, of course. But some kind of classical evolution seems to be suitable here. The soft fields have typically large occupation numbers. They are non-perturbative, classical. And hard modes are like on-shell particles, like classical particles. So that the quantum effects don't really play a very strong role here. And there are several ways how you can do it. You can take, let's say, just put classical gauge fields on the lattice, put hard and soft fields there, all of them, everything on a one single frame. I mean, one single method. And Paul and Jürgen and their collaborators have been studying this. And it seems to work quite nicely. Another alternative is that you really assume that the scales between hard and softs are separated, so that you describe these classical particles with using different methods. You kind of take your guidance from hard thermal loop theory and describe them by really putting particles on your system. So you have soft fields and then particles flying around there, by Mike and collaborators, or then you can put particle distribution functions, which in this, let's say, field are called Ws, usually W fields. And this has one particular feature, actually, that in this case, there's a fixed background distribution of anisotropic fixed background distribution, and there are some fluctuations around it, so that this is kind of works quite differently from these others. I will describe this a little bit in more detail. This is our approach here, what we are using, these so-called W fields. Maybe one should get some kind of picture about the scales here, what are in play. If we have this classical gauge scenario, so all scales then need to fit on the lattice. Here is my lattice cutoff, here's momentum scale, here is some kind of occupation number of the modes. It's very schematic, of course. The hard modes are sitting here, and here is the soft modes, which now are supposed to grow due to this anisotropy. And all of them, of course, have to fit here. But this is, of course, everything is gauge fields, so that they interact naturally, and everything should be fine. Except, of course, you have ultraviolet problems always when you hit the lattice scale. But assuming that there's enough window here, that shouldn't be a big problem. Yeah, the only real problem here probably is that you need quite large hierarchy of scales on your system. In the particles approach, you have a clear separation of scale. You have some kind of this classical particle distribution plus then the soft fields, and the lattice spacing now should be somewhere in between, so that your lattice cutoff can be much, much coarser, at least in principle, than here. And there is also here natural feedback between the particles and fields, because of course these particles are really moving in the background of electric and magnetic fields. They get bent by the fields and slowed down and accelerated, like the real particles, classical particles would. You only have to keep track of them. So that energy flows from here to here at initial times.
Sorry? How do you describe the particles within this field?
They are in this particle approach, they really are particles. You kind of keep track where a point-like particle is moving.
Describe them in the lattice.
They are not on the lattice. They are flying really ballistically through the lattice, so that they are in between the sites. You have a continuous variable, location variable, so that you actually kind of punch through the lattice brackets occasionally, so that this kind of delta function type kind of hit.
What about the back reaction? If you do that simultaneously, you evolve.
Yes, it's simultaneously. When the particle goes through, let's say, one bracket on the lattice, bang, there's an electromagnetic interaction. Particle gets, its direction changes and energy is exchanged between the lattice fields and the particle.
And feels the presence of particle.
Sorry?
It feels,
sure. That's the whole point. And particles also feel the background field, so that both really interact as in the way they should. There's of course some danger of oversounding if this particle momenta some of course will get slowed down so that they will occupy the same momentum region where these are. So one might worry about that. Then in this W field approach, what we are doing, we are now modeling distribution functions of particles, not particles themselves. And here it works out to be most convenient or kind of cleanest approach that we really use this. We have a static anisotropic background. We kind of have a particle bath in the system. There are infinitely many particles which have this anisotropic distribution. These don't contribute any current because it's completely charge neutral, this background. But if we deviate some of the particles from this, it gives us charged current. And these are these fluctuations of this current. This means, of course, that because we have a static background which is anisotropic, full isotropization is not possible at all in this approach. It also has clean separation of scales, and it's technically quite clean approach. I mean, you can take you cannot take continuum limits actually. Well, in principle, you can, yes, if you don't hit this lattice cutoff with these fields. I mean, in classical theories, you usually cannot take continuum limit, but these are not thermal, so it's a little bit different story. And it's easy, maybe easier to study systematics with this.
I'm missing the Nozzle scale, which is essentially a temperature or, let's say, energy density.
It seems like it's true.
Every this scale. Hard scale, QS.
I thought the hard scale is even above temperature.
There's no temperature here.
No, but yet. You have a mean average energy density, which you cannot possibly define temperature.
But these carry almost all of the energy, so that this is the temperature.
So that's QS.
That is QS. Yeah.
But then it comes to the initial moment.
When you expand, it cools down.
Sure.
These guys move to the left.
Scale, yes. Which is slow compared to all of the physics that Carl is talking about.
Yes.
Okay, but still, I mean, let me now come to the first one. Does it make sense to have a classical approximation for modes that are far higher than, let's say, the typical temperature or three times the temperature?
It's not, well.
Usually I would always guess that to get some, in a real system, some type of Boltzmann suppression. I mean, just,
Like
Boiler radiation, you're never discarding by classical fields.
No. In thermal distribution, of course, you have a flat spectrum here, irrespective of in the classical simulation, independent of the temperature, whereas if this is your temperature in the quantum system, you would have Boltzmann distribution that goes down. Now you cook up your initial distribution like this, and the occupation number here is so small that these are rather weakly interacting. I mean, these should be kind of on-shell classical particles which are not strongly interacting.
So this
dilutes slowly here. Remember that we are looking only at very transient effects here. It doesn't have time to thermalize. I mean, alone, these wouldn't thermalize, but because of this instability here, it starts to thermalize.
No, but I'm worried about something else. Namely, is a classical field description still valid? At momenta that are much more than, let's say, 2 or 3 times the temperature.
There is no temperature here.
It doesn't play any role here. You're looking at a distribution where the occupancy of modes is, by assumption, small compared to 1 over g squared.
Exactly.
So you can't actually start this description right at 1 over qs. You have to wait for a little bit. Yeah. But the occupancy is very large compared to 1.
Mm-hmm.
In that regime, you are in fact free to use either description you want, particles or fields.
So this is all in the weak coupling limit regime.
Yes.
That's clean. But of course, in reality, we cannot say the genes.
You don't have to put it so small. I mean, G.
I mean, yeah, but in reality, you have some real scattering.
Sure, sure. Yes, you have quantum scattering.
You effectively some cutoff at.
Absolutely. Yes.
You will always get some effective Boltzmann factor. This is at least my guess.
Sure. I mean, at the very end.
This you could in principle extend to arbitrary momentum.
No, if you start with the intuition that you're talking about. And you now try and put in some estimates about how long will it take.
Exactly. I mean,
this is the whole puzzle that underlies all this work. You get estimates that are disturbingly long compared to the real phenomena.
Yeah. This is the time scale what these hard modes do by themselves, hard scattering. But because of the soft field instabilities, I mean, you might get much faster evolution because of that. You might worry if you would have to study this hard thermalization alone without this instability with these hard classical hard particles, then that probably would lead you astray. But because of this, that you are really, these are kind of standing there, almost unchanging, these hard modes, whereas the soft fields are rapidly growing up. And you want to study this region. This should be valid.
This argument is, of course, not full thermalization that I'm worried about. But if you go to very high momentum modes,
yes.
The deviation from a classical description should go faster and faster. There must be some maximum momentum because the classical picture is
wrong. Yes.
Just the issue of
yes.
When the mode occupancy becomes
because quantum.
Order
yes.
of one.
That's right. In a way, I mean, of course, here when you hit the edge, I mean, this is where the quantum plays a role.
Again, and assuming it's very, very coupled.
Assuming essentially zero coupling.
I guess rephrasing Christoph's question is whether you can have high occupation numbers for arbitrary high momenta without getting into problems with the fact that you don't want this in quantum field theory.
Yeah.
So can you move these hard particles to arbitrary high momentum.
Based on the occupation number you give.
And have high occupation.
Yes, yes. If they don't have high occupation number, then you have, of course, problems. Then you cannot do classical evolution. It's quantum.
Can I say something?
Yes.
It's related to this color gas condensation. It's not really a peak at some higher one, but more like a plateau.
That's right, so all of the lower momentum.
So
yeah.
The two below models don't capture some interactions.
That's true, that's true. So that in
soft modes,
I guess what you are saying is that in principle this distribution should be flat down here.
Yes.
But these carry almost all of the energy because, of course, you have a huge number of modes here compared to the number of modes there, and these carry, and these have also higher momentum, so that the energy is here. And when you expand, of course, this kind of should come down. I mean, so that in principle, maybe there's not even a peak here, but it's kind of flat, and then it goes down. But the energy is really here, not in these growing modes here. But these are one of the problems which actually have not been really fully resolved in this work. Okay, here would follow some description of the theory, but I will skip this completely here. The equation of motion you recognize immediately, and here is the continuity equation for the particle distributions, and we little bit massage it to get to a form more suitable for simulation. You will see one scale in my plots, M0, which is a mass scale, which will become Debye mass in a thermal distribution. This is highly non-thermal, so it's not really Debye mass, but it would become Debye mass. So that if you want to get kind of feeling about the values, substitute M0 by Debye mass. And okay, lattice simulations, we have the distributions. I mean, I skip that. It's technically quite expensive. Quite expensive and causes big costs on the simulation. Let me say one thing which is probably necessary here. We have particle distribution functions, and it's a lattice field, this distribution function, which is my three-dimensional lattice, and at each point the distribution function describes the flux of particles to all direction, or to some direction, so that they are living on this lattice plus on these two spheres. So it's a five-dimensional manifold where the distributions are living. So this five-dimensionality makes it quite expensive. You have to somehow discretize the field on five-dimensional support, so that you need lots of memory in the first place to do this. And what we do, of course, because we have to somehow discretize distribution function here, I mean, which describes to the directions where the particles are flowing, easy natural approach is to use spherical harmonics. And that's what we do, expand them in spherical harmonics, which gives us some cutoffs based on L max, maximum L mode, what we include. That's a one cutoff, I mean, like 1 over A in the lattice moment, that this is L max is the kind of the maximal angular resolution on those background particles. And then some typical things, A0 equals 0 gauge. We use SU2 gauge fields just to simplify things, not much simpler than SU3. And so we have four lattice cutoffs, finite lattice spacing, volume, finite L max, it should be taken to infinity, and time step in the time evolution. I mean, all of these limits should be controlled. Sorry? M0 is this divine mass, or M infinity, many people call it. We call M0, some people call it M infinity, so that you can pick your choice. So we have this anisotropic distribution, this fixed background distribution, like this particle bath in the system. And because we expand in spherical harmonics, you easily, almost naturally, get kind of funny looking. They are not ellipsoidal, these distributions. You could cook up them more ellipsoidal, but we want to maximize the anisotropy for a given L cutoff. Then you tend to get these kind of multipole or propeller shaped distributions. And these are the distributions we have used, where there's a momentum asymmetry, a V to the beam axis divided by perpendicular goes to all the up to 0.015. So it's quite anisotropic, the distribution there. You should read them so that you have an arrow here at the origin and pointing to different directions, so that here it is very large and here it is zero. There's nothing going here to this direction.
Like the M0, you can find the anisotropy parameter.
Sorry?
The other way around.
Yeah, okay, yes, yes. Many people use it another way around. Oops. And if you solve for the growth rate in the linear region, analytically calculable region, you get this kind of result. Here is the momentum along the beam axis for those waves. And depending on the, I label these anisotropies by the Lmax number, 2, 4, 6, 8, 14, up to 28. And the larger the number, the stronger this anisotropy is. So that this smallest anisotropy, I just get a small dot here. I mean, this is the growth rate here at the maximum, at this wave number. Okay. And whereas if the largest anisotropy, I have much wider range of unstable modes, and of course much stronger growth rate. This is what happens in QED, say, in U1, or in weak fields in the SU2.
Is that worrying though? Because that means it's going to be quite sensitive to your L max, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, I mean, this, okay. Yeah, this, I have two cutoffs. I mean, this L max, this 28, this is not actually L max, this is L asymmetry. How many L modes are used to describe this asymmetric distribution. In addition, I have L max, which is the cutoff in the distribution function itself, which is higher than this one. So that for each of these cases, the L max should be taken to infinity, whereas these are left as it is because these parameterize just the anisotropy of the distribution.
So this doesn't keep growing as I go to larger and larger L.
Yes, no, no. doesn't, yes. These parameterize the shape of the distribution.
The initial anisotropy.
It's initial anisotropy. Or this anisotropy of this particle back. Yeah, this is a little bit confusing.
Wider and wider as you increase the anisotropy.
That's right. If you take infinitely thin slice, this would be flat, basically. All the modes are anisotropic with the same growth rate. Sorry, unstable. This is instability growth rate. So that the growth rate varies quite a lot. I mean, and with the largest anisotropy, it's of order M0, or this Debye mass in the thermal equilibrium. And I label the growth max, the wave number of this maximal growth by k star, which is of order m02. It grows also when I go to larger anisotropy. Let's get away here. Now, and what we want to study, we have a very modest goal. I mean, in a sense, we just want to study how the growth happens in the when we vary the anisotropy and try to kind of resolve it as well as possible. So we start with very small initial soft fields. And then we can solve even analytically, or doing some integral equations, differential equations, we can solve the growth rate at wave vectors at these soft fields. And they shall grow. And now the question is really, what happens when we hit this non-Abelian limit, when we cannot anymore neglect the non-linearities and we cannot solve it anymore analytically?
The colored glass kind of initial conditions with very strong initial fields.
Well, when you expand it a little bit, it becomes more dilute.
So you're not worried about those fields?
I am worried about those fields. This is not physical. This is too small initial fields.
Okay.
But this is, I mean, yes. Because, I mean, if you crank up your initial, I will show one plot. When you crank up your initial magnitudes to much larger values, then you, well, yeah. I mean, it's an added complication, let's say, to the system. But the growth is strongly affected by that. One option is here, this QED case. I mean, QED, of course, doesn't have nonlinearity scales at all. It just keeps on growing. If there's abelianization, as Arnold, etc., predicted, that would happen. But this is not seen in non-abelian theory. Another option is that this exponential growth just stops, and you are sitting there still. You grow much slower, with a slow diffusion to ultraviolet. And this seems to happen if the anisotropy is weak, if it is not strong enough. And, I went one for too far. The third option is that the growth at this original growing mode stops. And then there's a rapid transfer of energy to more ultraviolet modes of the soft fields. This is the UV modes of the soft fields. And the growth seems to continue exponentially. And this is what we seem to observe at strongly anisotropic distributions. So that the growth keeps on going, but it looks very different from this wider instability. And it can lead to almost full saturation of lattice modes. And generically, the system looks like that. If we plot, let's say, energy density of the system, there actually should be G minus 2 here, but I have dropped them out for some reason. The V fields and E fields, they start from very small values on soft fields. The growth starts to happen, ensues, and this one single, basically single growing mode goes. This is this linear region, and it hits this nonlinearity point, and something happens there, wiggling. Some reaction to this that things become nonlinear and they keep on then growing afterwards until they saturate at some point.
But at that point where you have this wiggle,
yes,
the saturation of scales is no longer there in the sense that you think of already the intermediate range between your hard modes and
your scales. Not yet there. It happens only up here. I will show you what's, I mean, here you basically are single, only infrared modes are occupied. So that, that's the non-Abelian point. And what we call these with different names, well, it should be some colors there, but they are so light that you're not visible. We call this first region here weak field, when everything is basically linear with this known method how it goes. And then we enter the strong field region when we cannot neglect these nonlinearities anymore. And this point is, I call it here, non-abelian point. And then this growth ends then at some point, which one could call saturation, end of exponential growth. This actually is not, doesn't seem to be a physical scale here, but it's a lattice cutoff dependent, this last case scale. And well, with small anisotropy, when we don't have very anisotropic distribution, situation looks like that. This is the weakest, this is the next weaker. I mean, L asym is 2 and here is 4. And here you see that they grow. These are different lattice spacings. I have 4 different lattice spacings. They vary here by a factor of 2. And the curves just flow on top of each other. Here is magnetic field energy, electric field energy, and I hit this non-abelian limit, some weakness, and a little bit of growth. As you see, energy grows something like one order of magnitude here. Still the energy density, but then it levels off this exponential growth.
So do you understand now the growth, the instability in the electric field?
Yeah, electric fields grow here too. That's right, yes. On a QCD, that's right.
But it's driven by the magnetic field.
No, but I mean, no, yeah, I mean,
another one, which I didn't describe yesterday, which comes from the fact that if you had a standing electric electric wave, a particle were flying along the direction of it, they get slowed down at the top and sped up at the bottom, so their concentrations tend to get bunched up at the top of the electromagnetic wave, and then they form an electric field.
You can also monitor charge density fluctuations. They also flow, I mean, which would respond to longitudinal electric fields, of course, due to Gauss's law, so that they would also grow here, so that the field, it's a dynamic situation. There's not single wave. There are many waves which are growing, and a linear position of them, so electric fields grow too.
The reason why they don't grow until a little later, is understood.
Sorry?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, why it's flat here? Actually, they start to grow practically immediately, but this one growing wave doesn't dominate energy yet. I mean, until it's much bigger than the rest, then you see it in total energy or energy density. It starts to grow practically immediately. If you know, this is one single wave, but when its amplitude is still so small, the total energy is distributed to the full system, so that in energy you see this kind of behavior. And the fact that they start at different levels just is due to the fact that I was lazy and didn't tune the initial energies carefully enough, so that they start at somewhat different levels.
The electric field and non-magnetic field?
Yeah? I have no idea. I have no idea. System becomes nonlinear, and my intuition kind of quits, and it's very interesting. Also. So I will show more detail. I mean, some.
In the same case, I see that the magnetic energy actually has an overshoot before it reaches the equilibrium value.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, yeah, there's more magnetic energy than electric energy. Somehow in equilibrium they are equal, so that they will want to equilibrate. I don't know why it is, but that's a dynamical question and nonlinear. And also here, this you can solve, I mean, in this linear rate. I mean, that, and here you see that indeed magnetic energy is larger than electric energy. There's no question here about that, so that in a way, in this kind of unstable system, it seems to be kind of natural that magnetic energy is, at least in this kind of instability, Weibull's type instability, magnetic energy seems to lead to electric energy. It's a magnetic instability in effect, and the electric fields just have to follow them somehow a little bit later.
Do you have a spectral distribution?
Yes, I will show.
What you said before, this depends on the initial conditions?
Yes, I will show that also. I mean, I have very small initial fields in this soft sector. Only the hard modes are there, so that I will show. I mean, things don't look so nice anymore there when we have large. With the stronger anisotropy, this is the L is in 40 and this is 20. Or actually, this should be 28, not 24. So that this is the most anisotropic case. You see still this linear region here. I have cut it so that it's easier to read. And electric and magnetic field at different lattice spacings fall on top of each other. You hit this non-linear limit, non-abelian point. You enter the strong field region. And now, different lattice spacings give you completely different end results. This is the coarsest lattice. Energy density stops here in physical units, not in lattice units, but physical units. And with the finest lattice spacing, you get up to here, which is, I mean, as you see, in energy density four orders of magnitude higher. And lattice spacing goes down by one order of magnitude here.
Also, in non-monotonic way, the electric and the magnetic fields do not reach a competition. 0.55, suddenly the electric field.
Yeah, they don't. Actually, it turns out that you are so strongly occupied here, fields are so large, and you actually hit the maximal UV limit on the lattice. So lattice dispersion relation starts coming into play, and you will see deviations between electric and magnetic fields.
Is the endpoint the compactness bound?
Or yes, it's the compactness bound. And that's what I show here. Here is my lattice spacing, and these points are the energy values. Let's look at these points here, which is the largest anisotropic case. And this is the value of the energy density where the growth finally stops. And this red hashed region is a region where you just cannot go. You cannot put so large magnetic fields on a finite lattice because you can only maximally frustrate your plaques, and this is the frustration limit. You almost go there, as you see. There's some kind of funny power law here, which is probably not very reliable. I don't believe that there's really that kind of power law. It might turn actually linear there, but it's just to guide the eye. So that you indeed are quite close already to this ultimate bound of the magnetic field. You just cannot grow more. And that's why it's like spacing dependent, of course, the energy density. So it seems that when you go to continuum limit, you would just pump more and more energy to higher and higher modes of this soft field. Of course, I mean, at some point, the soft field momenta and this your particle momenta should overlap so that you at least in principle, well, I mean, at least for physical applications, cannot go to infinitely small lattice spacing, but of course, in principle study, you can assume infinite separation of scales between these hard particles and soft fields, so you can just keep on going to finer lattice spacings.
Isn't this because you're indexed to the reactions of the particles?
It's one option that it's not completely neglected. I mean, the charge fluctuations duly need, I mean, and see the field so that the fluctuations of charge and charge currents fully feel the back reaction from the soft fields. But you have this particle bath there, which just keeps pumping new particles, which don't contribute to current directly, but I mean, you have a constant flow of particles going kind of an anisotropic distribution on the background.
In these systems, if you wait, once you have really strong population of ultraviolet modes, you will always produce distributions where the modes are sitting near the cutoff.
Sure, and here they are. Yeah.
But there must be another time scale. This is a time scale when the classical approximation for a given mode ceases to be valid.
Oh yeah, sure.
Coherence time.
I mean here.
The time scale is not simply the thermalization time or the
no.
time. It's certainly a time scale that depends on the momentum.
Exactly.
It probably gets much shorter when you go to higher momentum.
Yes.
This must be the time scale on which a Boltzmann district tail is finally produced. And this is missing here.
I mean, this, of course, this flatness here, this is completely lattice artifact. And you shouldn't, I mean, you have
there's
to cut them off.
There's a time scale where the classical approximation breaks down. And then on this time scale, you will also, you know,
I'm worried. The thing, I mean, I don't claim. I mean, this is not physical. As I mean, it's a cutoff effect, obviously. So that, and when you approach the cutoff effect, of course, you feel the lattice artifacts there. So you should really, if you want to make some physical predictions, cut them off before you hit this saturation.
Is a time scale, but not Chris was talking about
something. I'm saying that there's a physical time scale where a classical approximation breaks down. And this depends, this time scale will be momentum dependent.
It depends when. Please. Okay.
Your whole treatment is by choice, assuming that you have this bath of hard particles that are carrying the bulk of the energy density.
Yes.
Everything Kari is telling us is valid on time scales where that is still true.
That's right.
The possibility is growing, it grows many orders of magnitude, but wired into the treatment is that there's still this bath of hard particles that carries the bulk of the energy. Now, you can imagine what happens if you keep going. The energy that's going into the soft stuff has to come out of the hard stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that bath of hard particles has decreasing energy, decreasing phase space occupancy. At some point, those hard modes no longer have very large occupancy, large compared to one. At that point, the treatment of those hard modes is no longer valid.
Yes.
But having assumed weak coupling, which gives us the separation of scales, that's all physics that's taking place on longer time scales.
I mean, for instance, these dependencies on the cutoff, you don't see just using classical statistical theory without this separation.
Well, yeah, because you have the lattice cutoff on the other side of the hard modes, yes.
Yeah, but the extent of open would be even more severe. I mean, if you would go, the first picture where you put everything in the classical fields, and there is even no physical scale, where things could go wrong, but still you would tend to populate always.
Yes, at the end of the day.
Non-linearity, you would always populate near the cutoff.
At the end of the day.
The physical mechanism that prevents you from doing that must be simply time scales when the classical approximation breaks down.
Yes, exactly. Well, if the modes which are there, which shouldn't be there, I mean, carry significant amount of energy, then you of course are out of luck. That's right. But that happens relatively late in this business, so that I can show you some spectra, at least from these simulations here later. This is the spectrum actually. Yes, small movie. Here is this the B and E field growing, and here is the Fourier gauge fixed. I fix the Coulomb gauge and take the Fourier modes of it, and here is my initial state. It's white noise, thermal noise. This is the occupation number here, and it's very small amplitude. I'm here at that point, as you see. It's 1/k.
Basically. Might
you
choose
that initial condition, white noise? It's just one for lack of better. I mean, it's completely random white noise, so it's thermal, classical thermal spectrum, but very small amplitude. And I go on in time. This is my linear, this maximal growth rate should be here, where this K star is. It seems to go a little bit below that for some reason. And here the time goes on, as you see the previous pictures. It just keeps on growing here, and basically the shape here is the same shape as these unstable modes on the linear region, which I can solve. And then I hit this non-linear point. And suddenly what happens there that you kick your UVs. You start to flowing occupation to the UV modes when you become non-linear. And the UV modes get rapidly populated. Now you can, Christoph, start to worry, because this is the lattice cutoff here, the maximum momentum of the soft field. And you start to occupy these. But the occupation here is still, of course, compared to this 10 to the 0 and 10 to minus 7, so they don't really contribute to energy these days. And it keeps on growing like that. And at the end, when I saturate, I'm really almost flat, classical thermal spectrum again. At the end of the day, actually, this spectrum is is practically 1 over k, at least this k. This very low momentum part is nonsense. I mean, gauge fixing just doesn't tell you what is going on there properly.
Are these occupation numbers?
Yeah, these are
occupation numbers.
Yeah, that's the funny thing. I mean, they don't seem to go... Well, actually, I should divide this by g's. In many of my plots, I have used the assumption that g is 1 because you can scale it away from these, and it's a little bit misleading. It never... Because at 1, you become non-Abelian, kind of non-linear here.
Look, just to say that again,
one over g is one
over g squared.
Exactly, 1 over g squared. Yes, yes. It's a huge number with the weak limit. Yes, I should have put here the 1 over g squared, but because my simulations were, I mean, the g doesn't appear anywhere, so I didn't mislabel the plot here. Yes.
But in reality,
G is 1
now, so...
Sorry?
But in reality, G is
1. Yeah, in reality,
so
it is
1.
Yes. So,
you said the saturation is lattice aperture?
Energy saturation seems to be, because if you have a bigger lattice, smaller lattice spacing, this just continues here. So you can pump energy to this.
This flat part of the first curve is... You shouldn't take it seriously.
No, yeah, sure, not. Yeah, I mean, this is classical thermal equilibrium, and as Christoph says, this is not the quantum. I mean, quantum equilibrium would be something like I'm exponentially decreasing at the very end, and this is classical. So it's not physical in the sense, but it shows that you keep pumping lots and lots of energy from the hard modes to the soft fields. And very surprisingly, you really kick up the UV modes of the soft fields very efficiently.
So what happens to the left of the vertical line? You said you didn't trust that. Why?
This very lowest momenta, one occupation numbers one shouldn't trust, because this is due to gauge fixing. You have to fix the gauge if you want to look at occupation numbers. You have Grebov copies, etc. And using different definitions for the occupation number, you can actually even have this going upwards at this very low moment.
The boundary conditions and pops, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's in general, you never should fix a gauge, of course. But sometimes you cannot avoid it.
Some physical observation.
I mean, we tried gauge invariant observations, like energy density, b squared. I mean, it doesn't work. I mean, you don't see this kind of behavior. It looks completely different. Or very different. You don't see this saturation. I mean, that you stop the growth at this wave number in the energy density, because b squared is a convolution of momenta, so that b squared at some momentum k is actually convolution of a field momenta, so that there is no clear definition what it corresponds to this on this a occupation.
This graph, in the right graph, what is the lowest scale of the particle
in the
thing? You have only the soft
moments
here.
In principle, I mean, we can have infinite hierarchy of scales so that the particles can be as far away as you wish.
In your calculation, though, is there any overlap between the particle scales and the soft?
In my calculation, no. Because this is kind of mathematical toy model, you could say. But if you put a physical value of g, of course, then the particles come down here very close to this and start to overlap. So if you want to make strictly physical applications, then this approach probably is not very good, because this really assumes infinite hierarchy.
So you don't have any reason to believe that this might affect the
thermalization? I think this affects thermalization. I mean, this is a real effect still, nevertheless, so that something like that could very well be there and thermos. I mean, this is basically what Jürgen and his collaborators were seeing also on their recent paper.
That kind of behavior we saw many years ago.
Really?
If you call that thermalization, it's something which you see in preheating very soon. I would not call that thermalization.
Well, I mean, here you get, in my case, I mean, I get thermal distribution. I mean, it's completely thermal, actually, at the very end.
Or like condition.
It's infinite temperature, isn't it?
Not quite, almost. Very large, but not infinite. Yeah.
What we see is that one gets after the stop of the growth and saturation. If there is a no momentum range which is isotropic, but far from thermal.
Which is weaker on isotropic case. I mean, this is the same stuff now, but with weaker anisotropy, the initial growth, you hit this nonlinear limit, and you start to populate this UV mode, but it stops. And there you stand. I mean, then you have a very slow growth. These all lines are at equal time intervals, so that clearly the growth becomes very slow here after that one. So at weaker anisotropy, you get this strongly occupied UV mode still, and then some kind of exponential fall off to ultraviolet modes.
We don't have these particles in there, but even for the strongest anisotropy that we can have, we get this Kolmogorov type behavior after saturation.
We don't seem to get with the strongest anisotropy. It really seems to flush to the almost, I mean, as much as you can squeeze in energy to the system.
In that case, you also get these very strong cutoff dependencies.
Here you don't. Here you don't. This is cutoff independent. I mean, it doesn't matter if you continue here. The energy here is so small that it makes little variation. Okay. Here are, if I slice those plots, I'm a little bit, quite a lot behind the schedule, but if I look at some particular momentum value here, and then 2 times it, 3 times it, 4 times it, so on, for both the weak and strong anisotropy, I see something like this. I mean, here is the primary growth mode, which grows with some specific momentum. This is twice the momentum, it grows also practically the same speed. And these are the higher momenta. And clearly, when I hit this non-linear limit, I mean, boom, all of these higher momenta modes start to grow very rapidly. There's some funny structure here which I don't understand. I mean, it just jumps up and down. And in the strong anisotropy, everything becomes more or less the same, whereas in weak anisotropy, you get a funny, some kind of spectrum. I mean, the lowest momenta have a very large occupation number. This again should be divided by g squared, and the higher momenta are much smaller.
Especially the features are even more pronounced.
Yeah, this is funny. I have no idea what this is. I mean, why suddenly they go down? I mean, but they clearly it's amazing. I mean, when this first mode, this long wavelength mode, hits this nonlinear limit, suddenly even the highest frequency C, boom, their occupation is kind of shaken. It's not clear to me if this is physical or if this is cage fixing artifact. It very well could be, because you have non-perturbatively large fields, you try to fix the gauge, you might get some funny business there going on. However, this is quite ultraviolet end, and that should be still safe for gauge fixing point of view. I don't understand. So that there are some problems there. I mean, what's going on there?
So we see also the low momentum modes, but not in these high momentum modes. And maybe for those cosmologists, I mean, if you take the low momentum mode, this, when you enter this nonlinear regime, this overshooting going down, people that studied inflatons coupled to fluctuations, they know this very well. And that's the point where you have the same energy in the background, right, in the inflaton and in fluctuations.
Yes,
it overshoots a bit, and then it goes back, and then.
Yes, yes, sure. That's right. Well, there you have a potential where you are rolling. Here it is more complicated, of course, so that no potential here where this happens. Okay. Well, I skipped that. I have some kind of back of the envelope or back of the stamp kind of estimate why this should happen. And you can kind of convince yourself from equation of motion that these. That the shape here should be kind of exponential, so that this is more or less linear, and just because of the nonlinear nature of the exponential of the equations of motion. But I skip that. We have been talking so much. I just flash this. System becomes isotropic at the very end of the day. here, if I look only modes which move along the beam axis, this primary growing mode is one of those, so they grow early, grow to large numbers, this is an arbitrary unit, and the perpendicular modes to that one, they grow much later, but faster, we catch up with that one when we enter this nonlinear region. And then there's some funny weakness, there's still some separation, but when we hit this full saturation, everything is isotropic. But of course that's unphysical, this full saturation. I have also some kind of snapshot of the system. This is now sliced from the system perpendicular to the beam axis. And what I show here is magnetic field strength, but one color component, so this is gauge fixed. So that the beam axis is this direction, which means that the hard modes are moving preferably along this plane, and the waves, these unstable waves, are perpendicular to this plane. So this is perpendicular to these waves. Initially, it's just white noise because of initial condition. When it grows, you actually, even on this perpendicular plane, you see some kind of long-range structure because these waves are not completely aligned along this plane. They are wiggling here, so you see that they are stronger and weaker regions of the magnetic field. And when you grow, it becomes clearer, this kind of structure. This is this linear region. And then you hit nonlinearities, you pick up higher momentum modes, and you go higher and higher momentum, and so on. And it looks quite funny at the end of the day. And at the very end, which I didn't find actually a plot, it becomes again random, like the initial condition. But I don't know what this wants to say to me. Is the current going along these funny fingers or fjords here, or is this completely gauge fixed in artifact or something? When I do the same using gauge invariant quantities, I see nothing.
And also, this is a single run.
This is a single instance.
So if you would just sample our initial conditions,
If you sample it, it averages out, but the instability is driven by kind of single configurations. You have strong fields and current going there, so that you should see it somehow.
And the width of these filaments still much larger than the cutoff?
Yes, in this case, yes. I have 240 points to each direction, so. And this is one slice only on the system. If you take the perpendicular slice on this point, you would see these beautiful waves. If you would slice it to the perpendicular direction, you would see these waves going up and down. But somehow this slice looked nicer because you have this strong development of those funny filaments. Okay, but with the large initial fields, many people ask me what happens. If we increase the initial amplitude, this, let's say, is the very small amplitude, which has this exponential growth. This is this nonlinear point here. It's difficult to see. When I increase the initial amplitude, the growth keeps on going, but it becomes weaker until if I am at very strong initial fields, even above this saturation, there's practically no growth at all.
Are isotropic large initial fields.
Isotropic.
So if you had chosen anisotropic large initial fields, which if you think of Colorado, you would see the same growth.
Could be, but it's not clear to me. But you had also very small initial fields.
Well, we have large initial fields, anisotropic.
Okay, I understood that point.
In your case. So you don't need.
So is there some difficulty in simulating that?
No. You have so many options to do here. Yes. One thing what is a mystery here is that what on earth powers this growth? And that's what we have been looking at. Why on earth you have this running away to ultraviolet so strongly? Because it cannot be the Weibull instability anymore. The wave numbers are just wrong. But the energy is growing exponentially, so that it's more efficient to pumping energy from these hard particles to these soft fields than it was before, because the energy is growing exponentially.
So this is saying that you don't have energy conservation in your system.
No.
You have particles, you have infinite energy, and you just pump it into your system.
So yes, but how? Initially it happens through the Weibull instability. But here the wave numbers are not where the Weibull instability is. How it happens, what's the mechanism which causes this growth? So that they're really, in this case where you are still growing rapidly, exponentially, the current distribution must be very peculiar there, and this magnetic field distribution. That's why we make these plots, and we try to see that, or do you see some correlations between currents, magnetic field densities, what's the shape of those things? But it's very messy situation. You try to eyeball some features out of that, but I cannot make any sense of these plots, not at least yet.
What's the scale of the Weibull instabilities? What sets the scale of that wave number?
It's the anisotropy. It's of order Debye mass, would be Debye, well.
So M0.
M0, yes. Larger, sorry?
Essentially the density of the plot.
So it's G times the typical momentum.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Is this fast pumping to the ultraviolet mode not very similar to just the scalar field? As far as I remember, it's more or less the same for scalar fields. It tells you that it's probably not dependent on some particular mechanism.
No,
well, in non-linear terms, you have some a squared, a cubed, a four, yeah. Okay. So you get twice the Earth rate, four times the Earth rate.
It's very, I'm just saying, it's very universal. There's no point in looking at.
No. It's not so simple. I mean, there's still some mechanism. I mean, that's fine. I mean, I believe it very well. And I kind of look at the equation of motion that what you would get is that upla. Sorry, I go up here. That I'm here, and if I would start take this initial condition, start to evolve, boom, it would pump up energy from here to the higher modes very rapidly. But what keeps feeding the energy here in the system? Because the energy is still growing, it's exponentially fast. Because we have these hard particles, this external flow. And the mechanism why the energy is transferred from this particle bath, why that becomes more and more efficient at this stage, that's completely a mystery to me and Dietrich at least.
That is, from what I understand, the situation that occurs, for example, in the theory of turbulence, the classical case, where basically you have a non-equilibrium cascade process.
Yeah.
Basically, you have this usually you can understand that you, in case of some structures, non-equilibrium structures that form in the non-equilibrium range of your scale.
Yeah.
For example, in the theory of turbulence, the structures are basically vortex filaments.
Yes.
Vortex filaments interact and stretch each other, and this basically is the mechanism, or it's thought to be the mechanism of this cascade process.
Yeah. It could be something similar here, I mean.
Yeah, you have to.
This is a region where truly is not abelian.
Yes.
So this is a non-abelian. You get better the structure of the field that is the result
exactly.
Of the growth.
I mean, something like that, what we have been suspecting, what we have been trying to observe it and measure it, I mean, and it's. In the non-abelian theory, it's quite complicated to construct.
They find this homobolo type exponents, this parallel behavior, as you describe. It just points out that if he goes to strong anisotropy, all of a sudden it's no longer slow because this homobolo wave turn is very slow, it's fixed on the it's static. Solution to
life
of the classic.
Yes,
this is very fast.
Yes.
This is like
comes up.
I don't know what you mean with homography, but I have in mind the homography, of course, is something people use for many different things. But what I mean is that in non-equilibrium classical field theory, we can have this kind of cascade phenomenon which are intrinsically non-equilibrium. And they are very useful in understanding why the energy flows in wave number space. I mean, in your particular case, of course, I should be careful because you have, from what I understand, a cutoff scale in between your hard modes and your soft modes.
Yes.
This means that basically something happens when your energy, your cascading energy, reaches this cutoff.
Sure, of course.
You can test only the results then what if we live in part of the process should be the part of the spectrum which is far away from the cutoff?
Yeah.
Once you leave the cutoff, then you start having some kind of normalization there. Yeah. It says from the fact that your energy cannot go further.
Yeah, yeah, that's, you are of course quite right. And this is what you can achieve with this fully classical simulation, which I think, I mean, are very appropriate, of course, to studying this process. You have everything there in your system. You have natural thermalization in it and everything. Okay, I'll let these artifacts are fine. I mean, we tried everything, no problem, and show some conclusions. So that what we see is what I have been telling you, that fast growth in UV part of the soft mode spectrum if the asymmetry of this hard mode is large enough. And the growth is fastest to the Z direction, actually, as I was sketching here at the beginning. Of course, you pick up the soft fields in this along beam axis, you occupy much more of those modes. And interestingly, of course, this is exactly where the hard particle distribution was depleted originally. I mean, you have less modes along the beam axis, say, are perpendicular. So that if the soft fields kind of rush up to the UV scale and fill up this hard mode hole, then you get more or less isotropic, possibly isotropic distribution. Rate itself is certainly sufficient for rapid thermalization. I mean, for large anisotropy, this is rather m0 m d by g times some number times momentum scale, so it's qgev, so certainly it's faster than 1 per.
This is also
assume some value of g. Yes, sure. I mean, of course, I mean, this is in asymptotically weak coupling, but then we boldly go and extrapolate g equals 0. I mean, alpha is still smaller than 1, so that's
the
boundary
of the g. I thought 0 was not 0.
Sorry?
I didn't understand why you wanted to divide by another g. M0 is a natural scale.
M0 is, yes.
Yeah, but the color class initial condition, actually, even for the hard scale, has occupation numbers 1 on g squared. So if you actually plug that into the distribution function, that cancels the g squared that would naively be out there from just the diagrammatic definition.
But the growth rate is really M0, and it becomes M0. Yes. Okay, and it's an interesting problem. It still warrants further study, and people are showing in. But there are problems in this scenario. For example, what are the right initial field configuration? We didn't even try that yet to do anything with it. And then maybe even more serious objection is that the expanding background. I mean, we did use fixed background. I mean, I didn't probably specify it from the beginning. We just had this anisotropy and no expansion. If you have a system which is really expanding and kind of tries to generate the anisotropy as it goes, it takes a really long time before anything seems to happen. And Paul did the simulation. Where did he have to go to 10 Fermi or even longer times? So you might remember.
Even longer times.
Even longer.
But
yeah.
I mean, this was again one of these things where he was choosing exponentially small longitudinal pressures to begin as sort of numerical control. So that comes back to point number one.
So unresolved issues, but one has to do this in order to really know what happens, I mean, at the very early stages of this process. So thanks.
Any one comment, because there seems to be so much on the market now. One thing that seems, to my impression, the same for all the different calculations, either your classical statistical field theory or using the separation of scales, if you just ask, what is the fastest process, the fastest time scale we can get from the simulations, say for not two unrealistic energy densities for it, you always get 1 or 2 Fermi, no matter what simulation. So if you just ask for the growth rate, what is the characteristic time scale of isotropization? It's always 1 to 2 Fermi, at least for low momentum. And then the differences come maybe how does it really all start with the initial conditions? If you say, I don't know exactly what initial conditions we have, and I'm a bit more modest and ask, can we find fast processes for isotropization on the timescale of Gauss and Fermi? And the answer is yes.
Well, except the growth rate of 1, 2 Fermi. Then you have to say, you know, how many e-fold times do you need to actually produce some interesting result?
That
result
again depends on the initial condition, whether you need 2 or 10.
Is this also the time scale for the bottom-up approach?
No, that's not. The bottom-up approach doesn't have this physics in front.
No, yeah, but there's different physics, but the time scale is
it's 1 to 10, yeah.
No, I mean, you see, this bottom-up can easily, well, if you call 4 the same as 1, yeah. No, it's in the same ballpark.
Yeah, if e-fold is the same, then you are getting to reach more or less a 4. Maybe half, that is
I mean, if you look at Paul's simulations now with
hydrodynamics. I mean, yeah, the fits now with hydro, you can vary the initial time at which you start your viscous hydro run, and then there's a bunch of a few other dials you can adjust to still fit the final data for elliptic flow, spectra, you name it. And you can vary the initial time from 1 Fermi over C all the way up to 2 Fermi over C now, and the both curves go right through the elliptic flow data. No difference.
So 2 Fermi is
it's still within the ballpark, yeah. It's within our margin of error.
You don't need to go down to half.
It's quite possible that you don't need to go down to half. It's a straw man, in my opinion.
But maybe it's a compromise.
Just bring it up, yeah, exactly.
I guess I would like to also point out that in these kind of classical or semi-classical treatments, you also leave out strong field particle creation effects, which could also help you to populate these modes. And those can be estimated, and again, they're on similar scales. So
right.
There are a lot of things going on at the same time.
Yeah, because it's collisional exact mode. So
you have the collisions, plus you have the particle theory, plus you have the classical instabilities, and everything.
Sure.
The other thing I think that's crucially missing from a lot of the simulations is that it's the Bremsstrom from the hard guys down. So there's another time scale coming from the hard guys flying in the soft background, and then they Brem off the gluon split essentially, and they half their energy. So basically, you take the hard momentum peak in your distribution function, and it starts sliding down in momentum due to this splitting. And actually, as they split, then the field, the effect that the field makes on them is actually gets stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's to some degree, at least, taking into account these classical simulations, of course. It's not a very quantum process, of course, what is there, something similar happens. I mean,
that should be in principle included in the classical statistical simulation.